Good morning. I'm Pastor Mike. Probably around the ages of like 7 or 8 years old, I was at my friend's house who lived right down the street from the house that I grew up in. You know, and I don't remember the thought process here, but we were in his garage and we were looking for something to do when we found some tennis rackets. And then we found a bunch of random objects. So our goal, our game that we were gonna do was to just take random objects and see how high we could smack them into the air. So they think about tennis ball, and then we smack it really high. Army man, then we smack it really high. It was a lot of fun, this game that we created. It was really innocent. It was innocent until we found a pile of rocks. Yep. So we took some rocks and we decided to smack them as high in the air as we could do it. And what added to the layer of fun to this is once you smack that rock into the air, you lose sight of it, right? So we had no idea where these rocks were going, which we just thought was hilarious, and we thought it was awesome. That is, until I heard a crash, the sound of glass breaking from my latest launch. I looked over to where the sound came from, and I saw that my friend's neighbor's really old fancy car's back window was shattered. And in that moment, I jumped on my scooter and I pedaled as fast as I could all the way home. And I got to my house and I ran through the door. I sprinted up the stairs. I got to my room. I shut the door. I turned off the lights and I hid in the corner. I ran away. As fast as I could, I ran away. But within a minute or two, there's a knock at the door. And that day, I learned a timeless truth that no matter how hard life is and how bad things get, you can't run away from your problems. No matter how hard or scary life is, you can't run away. Today, we are starting a new 6-week series looking at the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth is in a time period where life is really, really hard, and life is really difficult. This was a time period, as verse 1 is going to reveal to us in just a second, that the judges ruled in Israel. And the judges ruled in Israel because there was no king. And it says in the text, you see this over and over, but the people did whatever was right in their own eyes. So basically, one godly judge would rise up, but then the people would revert back to doing whatever was right in their own eyes. You can imagine if people are doing whatever they wanted, whatever they thought was right in their own eyes, you can just imagine the consequences. The division, the cruelty, the civil wars, the national disgrace, unbelief, the disobedience of God. I mean, this truly is one of the lowest points in all of Israel's history. So it's in that context we begin in the book of Ruth, but there is one more thing. On top of everyone doing whatever they wanted in their own eyes, there is a severe famine. There is a lack of food in the land. So although the book of Ruth is a beautiful story, there is much tragedy in this story, much like the tragedy that occurs in the lives of the people that we love. Our two main characters, Ruth and Naomi, they lose everything. Everything. But in the midst of losing everything, God is very, very present. In the book of Ruth, you're not going to see physical miracles. You're not going to see the seas being parted. You're not going to see the sick being healed. You're not going to see the dead being raised to life. But on every page of this story, you're going to see the power and the presence and the providence of a very good and loving God. Let's begin reading Ruth chapter 1, starting in verse 1. It's also going to be on the screen if you want to follow along there. It says, "In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and his two sons with him. The wife's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. So we are introduced to a man named Elimelech, and his wife Naomi, and the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Elimelech, the husband, his name means God is king. And Naomi, her name means pleasant. See, names are important as it usually reveals something essential going on in the story. Okay? So names would be given to children based on one of two things. They would name a child based on prophetically what they wanted to see their child be, like strong or godly or pure. Or they would name their children based on what they saw around them when the child was born. So in the middle of the struggles and the hardships of life, Mahlon means sick or sickly, and Chilion means frail or tired. Church family, let me introduce you to the sons of Elimelech and Naomi, sick and tired. So obviously, we know that this is a very hard time of life for Elimelech and Naomi, a time where they are sick and tired, where they are drained, where they are feeling hopeless mentally and emotionally and spiritually and physically. Have you ever felt like that? And when you're in a season of life like that, you worry. Elimelech worried about his family. How are they going to survive? How are they going to eat? And so he comes up with the plan that he decides he's going to move his family from Bethlehem to Moab, which is about 50 miles away. It's about a 3-day journey. Now, Moab and its people, the Moabites, they are pagan people. They are ungodly heathen people. They worship the false god Chemosh, and they held false beliefs. The Moabites, as a people and nation, they came about from Lot's daughter's family's incest with him, as they thought that that was the only way to carry on the family line. You can find that story in Genesis 19. The oldest daughter named that child born from that sin Moab. And the Moabites were enemies of God's people, the Israelites. They treated them poorly, and they actually ruled over them for 18 years. So Elimelech is taking his family from Bethlehem to Moab, a pagan nation which God forbid them to go to. So Elimelech, he made an ordinary, simple decision to do what he thought was best for his family. He did what was right in his own eyes. But that decision meant that Elimelech was abandoning God's land. He was abandoning God's people. Truly, Elimelech is running away, just like I ran away when that rock smashed that car's window. The man's name, who meant God is king, is not living like God is king of his life at all. But let's be honest here. If you were him, and there was a famine in the land, and you could not provide for your family, can you blame him for wanting to go somewhere else where there's a better economy, a better job, and more opportunity to provide for your family? I can understand that, can't you? But what we need to understand is that where Elimelech failed is that he was prioritizing his family's economic state over their spiritual conditions. In other words, for example, sometimes we think that if someone has a job offer, and that job offer is for more money, then that's God's will, and that's what we should do, and that's where we should go. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't, though. You know, I've known people who are growing and thriving spiritually. They are plugged into life groups. They are regularly attending and serving and participating in church. The whole family, their whole family is cared for. Their whole family is loved on. Everyone is growing. And then they move and they leave to take a job somewhere else with more money. And what this family discovers is that yes, they have more money, but they have less God. My encouragement to you, church family, is don't prioritize economics, money, over the presence of God in your life or in the life of your family, like what Elimelech did. So let me ask you, what do you do when times get tough, when times are difficult? What do you do? Do you trust and obey God, and do you stay in Bethlehem? Do you stay in God's land with God's people? Or do you leave and do you run to Moab? During the period of Judges, the nation of Israel, time and time again, did what was right in their own eyes. Elimelech is doing what is right in his own eyes. He's doing what he wanted. He did what he felt he must. He trusted his own heart. He lived out his own truth. So the question is, well, what happened to Elimelech? Did they go to Moab and everything work out? Let's continue reading. Look at verse 3. It says, then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and the other a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone, without her two sons or her husband. Why did Elimelech and Naomi leave Bethlehem? So they wouldn't die. A simple, ordinary decision that they thought would bring life brought death. Elimelech dies first. And we don't know, like, what happened. It just says that he died rather quickly upon arriving in Moab. Then verse 4 tells us that the sons, remember sick and tired? Yep, Mahlon and Chilion, they marry Moabite women. And here is another example of a simple, ordinary decision that has major consequences. Mahlon, you see, God forbids his people to marry outside of their nation, their people. And there's a reason for that, and we're going to get to that. But here, you see Mahlon and Chilion, they marry women from a pagan culture. They marry women who believed and worshiped the false god Chemosh. See, Naomi and her family already made one decision to reject God by leaving, and now they're making another decision to reject God and his people by allowing their sons to marry women that God forbid. You know, I've worked with a lot of students and young people over the years, and they often come to me and they ask me the question, hey, can I date someone who's not a Christian? Can I marry someone who's not a Christian? And then they go on to give me all of the qualifications and all of the reasons why they should, right? He's cute. He's got a great personality. He's funny. He's got a job. He's so kind. His family is so great. And these guys and girls think deep down that later on in the relationship, they're going to convert them to Christianity. And finally, when they're done talking, I tell them, no, it's not okay. The Bible tells us in 2 Corinthians 6 that we are not to be yoked with non-believers. And why does God do that? It's because he is loving. And God is giving us loving boundaries to set us up for the best possible God-honoring marriages and partnerships as parents. I mean, think about it. Why would you want to be married to someone that when your kid gets sick, they can't and won't pray over your child? Why would you want to marry someone who will not go to church with you, who will not worship with you, who won't go to life group with you? I mean, why do you want to marry someone who does not share your faith that drives your life and drives your decisions? Why marry someone who doesn't share your core foundational faith beliefs? For Mahlon and Chilion, they marry outside their faith. And verse 5 tells us that 10 years later, they die. Once again, it does not tell us how it happens. But all we know is that Naomi finds herself without her husband and now her two sons. the very people she left Bethlehem with in order to find life and prosperity in Moab, are now gone. And now all that's left is three lowly widows. It's tragic. Simple choices, major consequences. Look at verse 6. It says, "Then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughter-in-laws got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland. With her two daughter-in-laws, she set out from the place where she had been living, and they took the road that would lead them back to Judah. But on the way, Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, 'Go back to your mother's homes. And may the Lord reward you for your kindness to your husbands and to me. May the Lord bless you with the security of another marriage.' Then she kissed them goodbye, and they all broke down and wept. 'No,' they replied, 'we want to go with you to your people.'" So this next part of the story, honestly, it really confused me. And what I'm referring to is the actions in the heart of Naomi. And godly scholars, they kind of fall on both sides about what I'm going to explain to you. So we know that Naomi is disobedient as she leaves God's people, God's land. Now, maybe she did not have that choice. She wasn't a part of that. Maybe Elimelech, the patriarch of the family, made that decision, and Naomi had to go in obedience. But nonetheless, we see the entire family being disobedient. And then we see the family being disobedient again as they allow their sons to marry Moabite women. And now she hears the good news that God has blessed Bethlehem with food. And since we've already been kind of talking about meanings and names of things and why they're important, Bethlehem, the name of Bethlehem means house of bread. So think about it. In a famine, they leave the house of bread, which is ironic. So Naomi, she hears the famine is over. And I find this really sad. Because if she and her husband had just stayed in Bethlehem, if they would have had made the choice, the decision to honor and stick with God, then they would have experienced this blessing firsthand. They would have been a part of it. But because they were disobedient, the text tells us that Naomi only heard. She only heard of the blessing. She missed it. She missed it. How heartbreaking is that? The beautiful thing about this story and our God in general and the big old lesson that I hope that we learn today is that it's never too late to make the right decision. Sometimes to go where God wants you to be, you need to leave where you are. In other words, as Greg Groeschel said, to get to the right place, you have to leave the wrong place. Naomi, she finally made a good decision, an honoring choice to return to God, to return to his people. But as they're returning, and here's the part that really confused me, Naomi tells her daughter-in-laws to stay back, to remain behind, to stay in Moab. I mean, why would she tell Orpah and Ruth to stay back in a pagan nation? Why would she do that? Why would she not want to invite her daughter-in-laws to experience her God, the God of the universe? Why would she not want Orpah and Ruth to experience and to taste and see the goodness of her God? Well, on one side, was Naomi's heart bad and crooked? Could it be possible that Naomi is trying to hide her sin? To hide her family's sin of being disobedient to God over and over. First by leaving and then by allowing her sons to marry two pagan women. I mean, think about it. If two pagan women come back with Naomi, then everybody's going to know what went on. She can't hide that. So was Naomi looking out for herself and how she would be welcomed and perceived by her people upon the return? I mean, after all, you know what you don't see in this story? You do not see any type of confession from Naomi. There's no, "Lord, I am so sorry that we left you." You don't see a, "Lord, we are so sorry that we allowed our sons to marry pagan women." It's not in the text. So was Naomi more interested in returning for the food than returning to God? Was she even returning to God and her people at all? So was Naomi's heart bad and crooked, or was her heart good? Look at verse 11. It says, "But Naomi replied, 'Why should you go on with me? Can I still give birth to other sons who can grow up to be your husbands? No, my daughters. Return to your parents' home, for I am too old to marry again. And even if it were possible, and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? No, of course not, my daughters. Things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me.' And then they wept together, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung tightly to Naomi." All right, so here's the other side of the coin now. Was Naomi's heart good? Was she actually interested in what's best for her daughter-in-laws? Yes, everything that she said is true. She is too old to get married. She is too old to have children and babies again, or to have those babies, you know, grown up and being ready to marry Orpah and Ruth. So in the eyes of Naomi, was she actually prioritizing the livelihood of her daughter-in-laws over her own loneliness, over her own sacrifice, her own loss of family? I mean, was the best thing for Orpah and Ruth to get married as soon as possible, to have children and have a family that can provide for them and care for them and protect them? Because after all, Naomi didn't have that anymore. I mean, she knew firsthand the experience and the pain of losing her family and the reality of what that meant for her future. And maybe she didn't want that for her daughter-in-laws. So was Naomi's heart good or was it bad? I'm going to let you decide for yourself. But honestly, whatever her intentions and her motives and her heart was, it really didn't matter because Ruth wasn't having it. Unlike her sister Orpah, who made a bad decision and left Naomi to return to her pagan home, Ruth wasn't leaving. She was making the choice to stay no matter what. Look at verse 15 with me. "Look," Naomi said to her, "your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods, and you should do the same." But Ruth replied, "Don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And may the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us." When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said nothing more. So Ruth, she speaks for the first time in verse 16 here. And she tells Naomi, "Hey, don't force me to go. Like, don't make me go home. Where you go, that's where I'm going to go. Where you live, that's where I'm going to live." Ruth just declares such fierce loyalty and devotion to her mother-in-law. And then she confesses her love for Naomi and her desire to stay with her even until death. And then the most important thing that Ruth confesses is not loyalty to a person, but she confesses a declaration of dependence on God. "Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God." Ruth declares that she is no longer going to worship the false god of Moab anymore. She's not going to worship Chemosh anymore. But she's going to worship the true and living God of the universe, the God of Israel, our God. And her decision, her choice to choose to be in a covenant relationship with the God of the universe and with God's people, it changed everything for Ruth. Chemosh was not going to be her hope and salvation anymore. But the God of Israel would be. Ruth would not run away. She was willing to leave Moab. She was willing to leave a place not in God's will to go where God wanted her to be. And you need to understand that there is a ton of obstacles in the way of Ruth's faith. Her background was against her. Her religious pagan culture was against her. Her father-in-law, her husband, her brother-in-law, they all died. And she was left a widow without any support at all. And then her sister-in-law leaves her. And then her mother-in-law says, hey, don't come with me, stay behind. In the midst of all of that, and in spite of all of that, she trusted God. She trusted God. And by the grace of God, and only by the grace of God, was she welcomed into God's family. Church family, visitors, and people online, I don't know all your stories. I don't know where you have been, and I don't know the circumstances that surround your life. But I can imagine that some of you right now are in the wrong place. And you're with the wrong people. Some of you have made the decision to leave God and to leave his people. You have left Bethlehem, and you are in Moab. You are living in Moab, and I need you to know that that is the wrong place, and that there is no future for you in Moab. But since you have breath in your lungs, and here's the so what to all of this, all it takes is one choice, one decision that can radically change your life, that can change the trajectory of your entire life. One decision will make you leave Moab and return to Bethlehem and to return to God. And I don't know what that one decision is that will change your life. That decision could be a number of things. That choice could mean, you know, maybe cutting up your credit card. That would change your life. That choice could mean saying you're sorry for something that you did wrong. That would change your life. That choice could mean maybe forgiving someone for what they did to you. That would change your life. Maybe it's breaking up and breaking off that relationship that you know is no good. That would change your life. Maybe it's the choice to let go of that one person, man, who just tears your life down. That would change your life. Maybe it's making the choice to attend Celebrate Recovery. Confessing your addiction. That would change your life. And if that's you, I want to encourage you to see my man Hollywood after the service. So what is your one ordinary decision that could change your life? What's your one choice that is going to help you walk away from Moab and walk back to Bethlehem, to walk back home? Church family, know that your future is in Bethlehem. It's with God. It's with his people. It's not in Moab. I want to give you a few moments just to respond quietly where you're at, just to reflect upon maybe what God's doing in your heart. I want to give you just a chance just to have a conversation with God with what's going on. I'm also going to encourage you, will you please use this time to prepare yourselves as we're going to move into communion here in just a minute. So at your seats right here, just take a moment to respond. as a result of the sin that was between Lot and his daughters. Two children were born, and those two children became the nations of Ammon and Moab. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, there was a law, and that law said that no Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants for 10 generations may be admitted into the assembly of the Lord. This meant that all of Ammon and all of the Moabites, they were permanently excluded from God's family. Like, they were not welcomed. They were godless. They were enemies of God. So how then could Ruth, a Moabite, enter into the family of God? The answer is simple. Only by the sovereign grace of God. You see, law has a way of excluding us from God's family. But grace includes us. If we have faith. And that same grace and faith that welcomed Ruth, it welcomes you and I. It's available to you and I, whether for the first time or the 100th time. And that grace is available to you because of what Jesus did on the cross. And he took all the weight and he took all the penalty of our sins upon himself. And he died a very gruesome and painful death. And he did all of that because he loves you. I need you to know, church family, that your sin is a very big deal. But there is grace that is given to you if you want forgiveness. Will you make the choice to walk away from your sin? I want you to take a moment. Just take a moment to remember what Jesus did for you.